the interrogation by unbelief. John 9, beginning with verse 13, it says, "They brought the man who used to be blind to the Pharisees. The day that Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes was a Sabbath. So again the Pharisees asked him how he received his sight. He put mud on my eyes, he told them. I washed, and I can see. Therefore," verse 16, "some of the Pharisees said, 'This man is not from God, for he doesn't keep the Sabbath.' But others were saying, 'How can a sinful man perform such signs?' And there was a division among them. Again they asked the blind man, 'What do you say about him since he opened your eyes?' 'He's a prophet,' he said. The Jews did not believe this about him, that he was blind and received sight, until they summoned the parents of the one who had received his sight. They asked them, 'Is this your son, the one you say was born blind? How then does he now see?' 'We know that this is our son and that he was born blind,' his parents answered. 'But we don't know how he now sees, and we don't know who opened his eyes. Ask him. He's of age. He will speak for himself.' His parents said these things because they were afraid of the Jews, since the Jews had already agreed that if anyone confessed him as Messiah, that he would be banned from the synagogue. And this is why his parents said, 'He is of age. Ask him.'" And so as we, especially this season, as we approach Christmas, and we see it more and more in our world today, is that we are constantly going to be met with people who oppose the gospel. We are constantly going to be met with those who viciously attack the gospel. I don't know about you, but I go to Walmart or the grocery store or wherever it is, and I purposefully say Merry Christmas just to offend people. I really like doing that. Even if they say Happy Holidays, no, it's Merry Christmas. And we see that going on in our world more and more so, is that people are offended at the gospel. And actually, the gospel message is offensive. The cross of Christ is supposed to be offensive. And so that's what we see in John 9. We see different responses to the gospel. And as we continue to take our break from 2 Corinthians and continue to look at the 9th chapter of John, we must start with our context before discerning the meaning. The broad context, if you'll recall, of John's gospel is written to a church in which he pastors. Because of some false teaching that had crept into the church, John's main concern is the deity of Christ. And he wrote to them, assuring them that this man called Jesus is in fact God's son. For instance, if you'll consider John 20, verse 30 through 31, which I believe is the key verse in the Gospel of John, it says, "Jesus performed many signs in the presence of his disciples that are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah," the what? "The Son of God, and by believing you may have life in his name." And if we also consider 1 John chapter 5, verse 13, which says, "I have written these things to you who believe in the name of the Son of God, so that you may know that you have eternal life." So that's the entire purpose of John's writings, is to assure those who have confessed Jesus as being the Son of God have eternal life, while at the same time it is to reveal the unbelief of those who confess otherwise. And this is what we see all throughout John's gospel, especially whenever you contrast chapters 8 and chapter 9, which we did last week. The unbelief of the Jews of chapter 8 is strictly pitted against the blind man receiving his sight in chapter 9. The man born blind, as we may recall from last week, is an exact depiction of all of us without Christ, that we are all born blind. We are all born with a nature to sin. We are all born into this world as enemies of God. We are born with the inability to see the truth apart from the Holy Spirit revealing the truth to us. And we are sometimes confronted with a difficult question. I don't know if you've ever been asked this question before, But what about the innocent people who have never heard the gospel? Surely God wouldn't send innocent people to hell, would he? And then whenever we take the truths of God's word, we rightfully can answer, there are no innocent people. For Romans chapter 1 tells us that what can be known about God is evident among them because God has shown it to them through the things that he has created. And so you have someone out in Africa, let's say, and who's never heard the gospel per se, and you say, well, how can someone be held accountable? Well, God has revealed himself to that person through the things that he has created. And then so the question then becomes is, what do they do with the knowledge that they have of God? And Paul answers that also for us in Romans chapter 1. It says that they suppress the truth by their unrighteousness. They refuse to believe. And as we'll see for a brief time together this morning, that is exactly what happens to those who call into question the validity of the miracle performed by Jesus in the life of this man who was born blind. Works which should have been attributed to God. This man named Jesus, who should have been worshipped as God, is met by the willful unbelief of not only the Pharisees, but also the crowd and even the parents of this man who was born blind. And so these things we will consider this morning are whenever faith meets skepticism, whenever faith meets formalism, or we could say legalism, and this evening we'll consider when faith meets fear, and we'll seek to answer the question, what should be the condition of our faith whenever we meet such people? So first of all, faith is met with skepticism. If you'll look with me at verses 8 through 12, it says, his neighbors and those who formerly had seen him as a beggar said, isn't this the man who sat begging? Some said, he's the one. No, others were saying, but he only looks like him. He kept saying, I'm the one. Therefore they asked him, then how were your eyes opened? He answered, this man called Jesus made mud, spread it on my eyes, and told me, go to Siloam and wash. So when I went and washed, I received my sight. And in verse 12, they ask, where is he? To which the man responds, I don't know. Now, we won't spend a great deal of time on this because we looked at it briefly last week in our conclusion. But notice as a quick aside just how quickly the enemy begins to work at the moment of new faith. This man had just received his sight, and immediately he begins to be attacked. Now, we know that from reading on in Scripture that this man didn't come to see spiritually until verse 38, where he makes the proclamation, I believe, Lord. But up until this point, the devil works extremely hard to prevent him from making such a proclamation. It begins with the crowds who were skeptics. Then it is tested a bit more as he stands before the religious leaders. And then even more so as this man's own parents will not admit that this change which has taken place in the life of their son is directly related to this man, Jesus Christ. And as we've studied in 2 Corinthians 4, that the gospel is veiled to those who are perishing because the God of this age has blinded the eyes of unbelievers. And the same tactics are still used today, aren't they? The devil continues to take the eyes of those who have caught just but a glimpse of the gospel and has blinded them. He blinds them through skeptics, through legalists, and through inflicting fear. And so the scene that we have in verse 8 is not really any different than what we see in any small town community today. I'm sure that most of you probably grew up in small community. Actually, the town that my wife and I grew up, Osceola, is twice the size of Washburn, Missouri. And so we grew up in a really, really small town. In fact, I've lived in a small town all of my life, except for the 2 years that I lived in Kansas City while going to Midwestern Seminary. Let me tell you, Kansas City was a culture shock. Took me by surprise. You walk into, I didn't think there was anything wrong with going to the grocery store in cowboy boots and shorts, but apparently there is. You get a lot of funny looks whenever you do that. But we all know what happens in small towns, don't we? It doesn't take long for word to get around of some events that are happening, whether those events are good or whether those events are bad. Everybody knows everybody, and everybody knows what's going on in everybody's life. That's just how it works in a small town. There are some people who seem to try to make it their living to make sure that everybody in the town knows what's going on in everybody's life. So if you think about it, this is a small community setting. This man, born blind, is sitting outside the temple begging, and he's been doing this his entire life, which is the only way that he could earn money. And so you have a Jewish father who wakes up early one morning, and he passes by the temple. And as he passes by, he hears the mutterings and the groanings of a man begging for money. The next day, he hears the same thing, and the day after that. And after a while, the father reaches a point where the begging just becomes kind of white noise, kind of routine, kind of mundane. And he's used to it. He goes by the temple, and he hears this guy, and he said, "Oh, there's a blind beggar. I'm going to go right on past him." Nothing's changed. It's like whenever you go to work in a small town, you pass by the grocery store at 6:45 in the morning, and you meet Mr. John. Mr. John waves, you wave. I mean, everybody waves in a small town, right? Or at least they should. You pass by Mr. John at 6:45 in the morning on Monday. You pass by him on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And every morning you expect to see Mr. John at 6:45 as you pass the same place going to work. And then the day comes where you're on your way to work and you don't see Mr. John. And you're wondering, what has happened? Where is he at? And you become concerned. In the same way, the Jewish father, passing by the temple, would have noticed the silence. Where is the blind man? He goes home and he tells his wife and he says, "Honey, I had an unusual quiet walk to work this morning. You know the guy who always sat outside the temple begging? I didn't see him. I didn't hear him. Where was he? Where was the guy who was always begging for money?" And so pretty soon the entire town begins to notice that this man is no longer here. And then finally someone sees him and he says, "I think that's the guy, isn't it? Isn't that the guy who sat outside the temple begging?" And someone says, "Yes, that's him." And then the other said, "No, I think that's just someone who looks like him. This guy's been blind all of his life. No one has ever been made to see who was born blind. It's never happened." Very skeptical, very mysterious, this event that has taken place in this blind man. And so they say, "No, he just looks like him." Others said, "I think he's the one." And the whole time the blind beggar's, he's leaping up and down. He says, "I'm the same guy." "Well, if you're the same guy, then how did you come to see?" "Well, I met this man named Jesus, and he spit in the dirt, he made mud, he put it on my eyes, told me to go wash in Siloam, and I came back seeing." "You're completely out of your mind." "I'm not out of my mind." "Well, where is he?" The blind man says, "I don't know." And so it is with those who have been saved, those who are blind from birth. We are nothing but beggars sitting on the side of the road. We are in a pitiful condition. We are totally lost in our sin. And then one day we meet a man named Jesus. He gives us the ability to see. And then all of a sudden our friends begin to wonder, "What in the world has happened? How come you are not like the person you used to be?" They're surprised at the change that has taken place. It's a complete mystery to them. They don't understand why you no longer, as Peter says, why you no longer get involved in the things that you used to do. They are skeptic, and they say, "I think it's the same guy. Well, if it is, he's definitely changed." Maybe some of our friends or family will say, "No, it's just someone who looks like him." And then we are forced to tell them, "No, I am the same on the outside. But on the inside, I've been changed. I once was lost. Now I'm found. I was once blind, but now I see." One author has stated, "The unsaved are always skeptical of God's miracles. When one of their fellows is saved, they cannot deny that a radical change has taken place, though the nature of it they are completely at a loss to explain. They know not the manifestation of Christ in the outward life of a quickened soul is due to Christ now dwelling within him. Yet even the unbelieving world, now I like this quote. He says, yet even the unbelieving world is compelled to take notice and indirectly acknowledge that regeneration is a real thing. Because they know that something has taken place. They can't explain it. It's a complete mystery. But they know that you are not the same person that you used to be. And so the blind man meets the skeptic in a lot of the way that some of us, or in the same way that a lot of us have done. Secondly, faith meets legalism or formalism. Verse 13, it says, they brought the man who used to be blind to the Pharisees. The day that Jesus made the mud and opened the eyes was a Sabbath. Uh-oh. So again, the Pharisees asked him, how did you receive your sight? So for some reason, the crowd felt compelled to take this man who was formerly blind to the Pharisees. And there are two suggested reasons for it. First, it's possible that they may have truly, genuinely been perplexed that a man who had been blind from birth is now able to see. As we said earlier, that's something that has never happened. So perplexed as they were, they decided to do what anyone else would do. I'm sure the pastor will know what's going on. I mean, I've never seen anything like this before. So they take the man to the Pharisees for answers. The second option is that knowing that anyone who confessed Jesus as Messiah would immediately be banned from the synagogue, they took the man to the Pharisees. Either way, we don't know their motive in bringing the man to the Pharisees. However, I believe that there is good evidence that the latter is probably more appropriate. The word bring in some of your, or brought in some of your translations may be rendered bring. They bring him to the Pharisees, which is a word that means by force. So it wasn't just, oh, this is good news. Let's go see the Pharisees and have a nice day, have a nice talk. The word bring usually is rendered to be brought in by force, even against his own will. So they brought him to the Pharisees, which indicates that they were trying to get him in trouble for professing this man named Jesus. So as he stands before them, he finds himself in a very serious situation. It was no secret that the Pharisees, how they felt about Christ, everyone knew their disdain for him. And standing before the religious leaders, this man finds himself as though he was standing before a grand jury. And now he must give an account of the events that have taken place in his life once again. And so there are a few things to notice about the blindness of the Pharisees. But before that, we notice the problem. What is the main problem with the Pharisees? It isn't the miracle. They don't even believe that the miracle has actually happened. That's why they have to call the man's parents to confirm that he was even born blind. So the initial problem isn't with the miracle. They're even skeptical of Christ. They believe this man to be a sinner. So therefore, a sinner cannot have done the things of God. He is not even from God. And so their biggest problem out of all of this was that this event took place on the Sabbath day. And the first thing that we will see about willful unbelief, and we'll have to finish it this evening, is that willful unbelief sets false standards. We all know the fourth commandment. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. You are to labor 6 days and do all your work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath to your Lord, to the Lord thy God. And see, in the Pharisees, they were notorious for taking the law and building kind of a wall around the commandments, making them impossible to keep and making them to be more than what God had actually intended them to be. For instance, whenever it came to the Sabbath, the rabbis had a rule that people were not to be healed on the Sabbath. And so you go through the town on a Saturday, and here lies... that's what happened to John. That's why you didn't see him at 6:45. He's broken his leg. And so here you go by John. You see John. He's laying on the side of the road, and his leg hurts. It's broken. And you're wondering, what in the world can I do for John? And you look at your watch, and you say, well, it's the Sabbath. I really can't do anything for him. John, you hang tight until tomorrow, and then I'll come back, and we'll deal with the situation then. That's really what happened. You couldn't even give a guy medicine on the Sabbath without breaking the law. And so you'd have to let the poor guy just lie there. And it's important that as we go through this to take note that Jesus did not break the Sabbath. He spat, which back then was viewed as medicine. Saliva had medicinal purposes. So thus making medicine would have been in violation of their interpretation of the Sabbath. Also, with that saliva, what did he do? He made mud. Ah, you're making dirt. You're in violation of the Sabbath. And then lastly, what does Christ do? Puts it on his face and he heals the man. That's definitely in violation of the Sabbath. You're supposed to let the man just rot away until the next day. And this certainly isn't what God meant by keeping the Sabbath holy, is it? That no works of mercy or grace should be shown on the Sabbath is so far removed from its original meaning. The Pharisees, as we've already mentioned, built walls around the law. It would be illegal to, some of us, we got those, the older I get, the longer my eyebrows become, and so every once in a while I look in the mirror and there's this one just sticking straight out, looks like a unicorn, and it would be illegal to pluck that thing on the Sabbath. I'm serious. I mean, that's how bad, you think I'm lying, but it's not. It's illegal to do almost anything. And that's what Jesus meant whenever he says to the Pharisees in the other gospel, you heap heavy burdens on people, but you yourself are unwilling to help them out. You tell them what they can and cannot do while ignoring your own laws, and you make people feel like the scum of the earth for violating your interpretation of God's law. So why did they do this? Why did the Pharisees create this big wall around the law? Well, the religious leaders, I believe, understood that keeping the law of God was impossible. You cannot keep the commandments. So instead of seeing Christ as the Messiah, and instead of looking to him by faith, as we've seen, is that the law is to do what? Is to point people to Christ. They're to look to Christ by faith in the law. If the law is read correctly, that's who they should be seeing. But instead, they refuse to see. And so they would make other laws. Say, I cannot keep commandments 1 through 10. And so I'm going to come up with commandments 1 through 400. If I can't keep the law of God, then I'm going to make it absolutely impossible for anyone else to keep the law of God. And why did they do this? To promote their own self-righteousness. To be hypocrites. They raised the bar of the law extremely high in order to boast of their own holiness before people. Calvin, in his commentary, states, hypocrisy is always proud and cruel. Being swelled with a false opinion of their holiness, they were chiefly wounded by the doctrine of the gospel, which condemned all their counterfeit righteousness. And above all, they fought for their power and kingdom under the pretense of endeavoring to maintain the law. So they set false rules, false standards in order to rule people. They set false standards in order that people might be in awe of their righteousness, which they claim to have. But whenever Christ comes on the scene, he completely flips their world upside down, doesn't he? He's viewed as a radical. He's viewed as a lawbreaker. So it may or may not be correct, but I kind of have this notion that whenever Jesus performed this miracle on the Sabbath, I kind of think that he did so on purpose. Is that too far-fetched of a notion? I don't think so. For instance, we already see that Jesus runs into the same predicament in John chapter 5 whenever he heals the paralytic. There's a man, if you'll recall, that was waiting by the pool. He was waiting to be thrown into the pool after it had been stirred so that way he may be healed. But he's paralyzed, right? He can't do anything. Someone's got to pick him up and put him in the pool. Well, it's the Sabbath, so no one's going to pick him up because that would be illegal. Don't pick up a crippled man on the Sabbath. You'll get in trouble. And so what does Jesus do? He comes by and he says, "Hey, would you like to walk?" The man says, "Are you kidding me? I've been crippled for 38 years. Yes, I want to walk." And so Jesus says, "Pick up your mat and be on your way." So what does the man do? Picks up his mat. And Jesus, in the fifth chapter of John, it says that he kind of slips off. And so as this man is picking up his mat, the Jews ridicule him for doing it. And this is what they say. "It's the Sabbath. It's illegal to pick up your mat." I mean, really, this is a ridiculous situation. And so here we are a few chapters later, and there's a man blind from birth. Again, it's the Sabbath, and Jesus has already been persecuted for healing on the Sabbath. And so it's like he looks at his disciples, looks at the blind man, and he says, "Hey, watch this. This is really going to get him." So he spits, makes mud, and causes the blind man to see. Not only does he break their interpretation of the Sabbath, but he does it in three ways. They say, why in the world would he do this? In order to show them, as we have already said, that as Jesus has already said, rather, that by your traditions, you are sinning. Because you are focused more upon man-made laws and keeping those than you are the law of God. It is to show them that they are hiding behind the guise of self-righteousness. And we see how adamant they are about their own righteousness. A little later on, the Pharisees, they question the man a second time, and the man is so irritated by their response, he gets a little sarcastic, and he says, "Do you want to become his disciples too? Do you want to follow this man named Jesus? You're so intrigued, you're so interested about this. Why don't you follow him?" And what do they say? We're Moses' disciples. We keep the law of Moses. Now here's something I want you to get about willful unbelief before we wrap this thing up. Jesus says later on in John chapter 5, "Do not think that I will accuse you to the Father. Don't think that I'm going to tell on you. Your accuser is Moses, on whom you have set your hope. For if you believed Moses, you would believe me. Why? Because he wrote about me. But if you don't believe his writings, then how will you believe my words?" We're Moses' disciple. And Jesus says, if you were truly the disciple of Moses, you'd be my disciple as well. So thus the Pharisees knew. They knew that this miracle was nothing short of divine. They knew that Jesus had come proclaiming to be the Messiah. They knew all the things that Moses had said about him, yet because of their disdain, and we could even say because of their hatred towards Jesus was so strong, and because of their want for self-righteousness was almost unbreakable, they absolutely refused to see. This is willful unbelief. I have, as we'll see this evening, I have all of the evidence before me. But I'm going to turn around and walk the other way. That's why they ask the question at the end, are we blind also? Are we blind too? They thought that they had light. They thought that they could see, yet in reality, they were more spiritually blind than this man who had been born physically blind. And we meet people even in our day who are the exact same way. We meet people who claim to be Christians because of righteousness that they do. The majority of the people that you meet, if you ask them, you say, are you a Christian? Will say yes. Why? Because they have renounced their sin? No. Because they have repented? No. Because they have looked to Christ by faith? No. Because they do good stuff. Because they act like good people. The gospel, on the other hand, comes along and says it doesn't matter how much good stuff you do, you're still not going to make the cut. You're still dirty, you're still blind, and you're still totally lost. And what does a message like that do? It rubs people the wrong way, doesn't it? So it is with people in our day, is it same thing, same result with the Pharisees. And we have to finish, but just know that in our walk with Christ, and as I said in the very beginning, guys, I really believe we're going to come to a point where we see our faith being persecuted more and more as the years go on. But your faith is going to go through all sorts of trials. You're going to meet those who are skeptics. Is this really the same guy? Can you explain the events that have taken place? Why are you so different? I met this man named Jesus. Oh, don't give me that. What kind of philosophy are you taking? It's not philosophy. What kind of religion? It's not religion. What is it? It's a man named Jesus. Ah, there's got to be more than that. No. You're going to meet the skeptic. You're going to meet the legalist. Those who set false standards in order to promote their own self-righteousness. They're going to come down harder on you than they are anyone else. They're going to hold you to maybe even a higher standard than anyone else. This evening, faith is going to meet fear. As we see the parents coming before this group of Pharisees, denying the change even in their own son's life, you would think that out of all the people, the parents would be excited that their son, who had a disability from the day he was born, now could see. But instead, because they feared the Pharisees, they refused. But we see that this man's faith, as it meets trial, does what? Gets bolder, gets stronger, and becomes more evident as he proclaims Jesus. As we seen last week, I met this man named Jesus. Then you go on later, he says, perhaps he is someone from God. You go on later, he's a prophet. Not the prophet, a prophet. And then you go on later, and he said, he is Lord. So this man's faith continues to progress. And I hope that it is the same with us whenever we find our faith under fire. That we don't cower down to the self-righteous or hypocrites. That we don't feel as though the change that has taken place in our life has done so in vain. As people are skeptical with this. As our friends and our family want nothing to do with us. As they deny the miracle of God that has taken place in your life, that instead of cowering down and hiding, that we become braver and bolder and more courageous for Christ. We're going to be faced constantly with people who are skeptics, people who like to inflict fear, people who are legalistic in their interpretation of Christianity. But our responsibility is to grow in our faith, to become more like Christ, and to share the gospel more boldly than ever, that those who are blind may be able to see.